Good morning, everybody. Hope you're doing well. More great questions from the fine listeners at freedomain.com. We will start with, hey, Steph, how are you preparing or have prepared Izzy, your daughter, 15 years old, almost 16, for the harsh world in the context of peaceful parenting? It's a fine, fine question, and I really, really do appreciate you asking it, and I will tell you what the plan has been. So far, so good, but we shall see. Now, so there's sort of two questions or approaches of how to toughen someone up for the world. The first is to keep them relatively sheltered from adversity until they gain the skills and strength, and through that being sheltered, they gain the skills and strength to deal with crazy, disruptive people in the world. And that is the childproofing the home, right? So you don't just let a kid tumble down the stairs. You don't let the kid stick forks in electrical sockets. You keep the kid safe until the kid is old enough to understand the dangers and navigate through life accordingly. In other words, early exposure to dangers that can't really be comprehended weakens and endangers and might in fact kill the child, right? So that is the keep the child sheltered until the strength has grown to, and the knowledge has grown, and the wisdom has grown to deal with crazy people or crazy circumstances in life, is sort of number one. Number two is more around the analogy of the immune system and the muscles. And what that is something like, you want to expose your children to drinking from the garden hose, to playing in the dirt. You want to have the child run around like crazy, because that builds the muscles, that builds the immune system, and they end up stronger. So these two approaches are often in conflict with parents, in the hearts and minds of parents. Because on the one hand, you say, well, gee, if I shelter my child from the craziness of the world, then they will be unequipped to deal with the craziness of the world. It's like if you are, I don't know, some European family and you decide to raise your kids in Japan, but you only teach them English, some British family or whatever, you decide only to teach them English and not Japanese, then they will not really be able to function very well in the Japanese society because they don't speak the local language. So how much and when and to what degree do you teach your children about the craziness of the world? Well, see, there's the world, and then there's your world, right? These two things are not the same, right? So yes, the world is full of crazy people. My world is not full of crazy people. I don't have crazy people in my life. I've gone through a very strenuous process over the past probably about 25 to 30 years of not having crazy people in my life. So the people I have in my life, they're all functional, they're all happy, they're happily married, they're peaceful parents, they're rational, they're philosophical, they're curious, they're, you know, they have great self-knowledge. So there's the world out there. I get all of that. But then there's your world. Now, do I want my daughter, or anyone really, to go out and have to deal with crazy people for the rest of her life because there are crazy people in the world? Well, I don't. So how much craziness is she going to have to deal with in the world? Well, there are, of course, crazy people out there, but you don't want your kids spending as much time with them. Well, you want your kids spending minimal amount of time with crazy people. Yeah, they're going to be crazy laws, and they'll be crazy this, that, and the other, crazy cultural stuff and so on. And so they have to be able to identify that stuff. But generally, if you speak your children the language of peace and reason and curiosity and self-knowledge, that's the language they speak. In the same way that if you speak your kid English, they won't be able to talk with someone who only speaks Japanese, right? If they only speak English. And so by teaching your kids the language of peace and reason and curiosity and conflict resolution and so on, then they don't speak the language of crazy people. So then when crazy people try to pull their crazy person stuff, your kids are like, I don't know what's going on here, don't really like it, and don't feel any obligation towards it. So I'm of the, if you raise your kids peacefully, they have an automatic immune system to crazy because they just don't speak the language. Now, that doesn't mean that they can't comprehend what's going on. Of course, you'll teach them that there are crazy people in the world. And through your actions of being a virtuous and rational person in the world, they will see how you're treated and they will recognize that there's lots of crazy, dangerous people in the world. But what you want to do is have them be themselves, peaceful, reasonable, good negotiation skills, good conflict resolution skills through their interaction with you and through the observance of you and your spouse. And then they go out into the world, and when people try to pull crazy people stuff on them, they'll never normalize it because they didn't grow up with it. They won't think it is the natural the natural state of human beings because they weren't raised with it. They'll recognize that craziness is a deviation from the norm of rationality that is inflicted by abuse and a lack of self-knowledge. So, I think it's a combo. You want to shield your kids from crazy because there's tons of people who get exposed to hardships and it breaks them. Right? I mean, this is what PTSD is and child abuse, you know, the higher adverse childhood experiences leading to a completely disastrous life that is shortened up to 20 years and cancer, heart disease, dysfunctional relationships, teen pregnancy, addiction, and abuse, and just all kind of overeating, like all kinds of terrible stuff that goes on. So exposure to too much adversity when you're young breaks you, right? In the same way that if you are lifting a weight at an appropriate weight, you will strengthen your arm. If the weight is too heavy, you can tear a tendon, you can pull a muscle, you can even break a bone, I suppose, but there's some bad stuff that can happen. So you want an appropriate amount of weight. You don't want to hide the craziness of the world from your kids when they're older, but you basically just say, well, in that area over there is where the crazy people are, and you don't really want to spend time with them because they will just make your life chaotic, you know. And as I've said to my daughter, if you invite difficult people into your life becomes difficult. So I think having a strong foundation of this is what is normal, and this is what is normal. It is normal to be rational. It is normal to be peaceful. It is normal for most people, right? I'm not talking about the, you know, 2, 5, or 10% of severely disturbed people, but it is normal for human being, and even they, I think, are largely the product of child abuse. So it is normal to have reasonable conversations. It is not normal to raise your voice. It is not normal to call people names. It is not normal to bully people. None of that is normal. None of that is normal for human beings. It's fine for, I don't know, apes and bears and whatever, but it's not normal for human beings because we have the capacity for language and reason and negotiation. So denormalizing crazy people means that they will see crazy people, they will recognize it instinctively as different from what they know and different from what they've experienced, in the same way that you may not be able to identify a foreign language, but you sure know that it's not the language you speak and you won't have anything to say back and forth. Well, that's teach kids the language of sanity and reason, and they don't speak crazy. They'll recognize it as something very foreign. They'll stare away from it, and they will build their bonds to other people who speak the same language of peace and reason. So, yeah, it's a harsh world. Well, it's actually a beautiful world. I mean, the world is as beautiful as can be conceived of. I'm just looking at the sky here, there's clouds and sun, and I've often thought that the world that we live in, like Earth, it could very well be the ultimate tourist destination in the universe. You know, all these beautiful clouds. I mean, I guess most life would need some sort of condensation evaporation cycle, but we've got a moon that looks the same size as the sun. There are these eclipses, there's this beautiful moon, these lovely clouds, sunsets. Like, we could be the tourist destination. We could be the Vegas, Orlando, Bali of the universe, and we don't often look around, appreciate, and drink in all of the beauty that we're surrounded by. So the world is beautiful, and there are a lot of people who are sane, happy, and healthy, and there are a fairly small number of people who are rational and good communicators and have a good degree of self-knowledge, and you just want to get to those people, right? You just want to get to those people. It's sort of like if you are, like I remember many years ago, I wrote and produced a movie, and we had auditions for the actors, and 99% of the actors were terrible. I mean, they're just terrible. So it's sort of like saying to a movie maker, I was like totally small time. Let's say you go to Martin Scorsese or some big time movie maker and you say, well, most people can't act. How do you prepare to make a movie in a world where most people can't act? Or if you're trying to look for a singer for a band, you say, well, most people can't sing. How is it possible? How do you prepare a band for the reality that most people can't sing? Well, and even if they can sing, maybe they don't have any stage presence, or maybe they don't have any creativity, or whatever, right? Maybe they can't connect with the audience, right? So when you go to movie makers and you say, well, how do you deal with the fact that most people can't act? You go to bands and say, how do you deal with the fact that most people can't sing? I mean, even, what was it, Genesis, after Peter Gabriel left, they went through like 400 singing auditions until Phil Collins decided to take on the role. And 400 people. And these are 400 people pre-filtered for being able to sing, and they just couldn't find the right person. I mean, it was the same thing after Freddie Mercury died until they got, that guy from Free and Adam Lambert. And I mean, you just need a particular kind of vocalist. So how do you deal with it? Well, you recognize that most people can't act. You recognize that most people can't sing, and you filter like crazy. So. The world is crazy. Sorry, the world is beautiful. A lot of people are crazy. Just don't speak that language and they won't have anything to say to you. The other thing too, if you're sane and confident and you build up confidence not by subjecting children to craziness, but by giving them sanity and health and reason, and that way, just being somebody who's sane and healthy and reasonable means that crazy people will steer clear of you. See, crazy people need to normalize their craziness. They need to think that craziness is the natural state. They're not crazy. Everyone else is crazy. And so crazy people instinctively avoid sane and healthy people, because a sane and healthy person will finally let the crazy person know, just through the interaction, not even if you say it explicitly. A sane and healthy person will automatically and almost through a process of, induction or example, or what's that thing where liquids go through a solid? I can't remember the word, but when a crazy person encounters a sane person, the craziness of the sane person becomes real to them because they can't blame it on the other person. Right? So if some crazy person comes along and starts provoking you and so on, right? Like I posted a funny picture of that my daughter took the other day where she took it sort of half fisheye lens facing down to my forehead, right? And I posted this and most people were like, ha-ha, mega mind and stuff like that. It was just a funny picture. And one guy posted and said, Steph, you must be super stressed, man, because you've got, some lines under your eyes and you've got some lines on your forehead. And I'm like, okay, I post a funny picture and some guy's just insulting appearance and all that. I mean, look, I'm almost 58 years old, right? Not bad. Not bad. Not too shabby at all. You know, I exercise, I moisturize, I hydrate. You know, it's pretty good. I've got, very little jowls and, very few lines and so on for, I'm pushing 60. So that is someone who is coming to a fun environment and saying something nasty. I have zero problems with my appearance. I mean, just so you know, I'm on camera all the time. I see myself all the time. I hear myself all the time. And I'm sort of reviewing videos and so on, reviewing audio. I think I have a wonderful voice for this kind of stuff. And I look fine. I mean, I have zero problems with my appearance. So, and somebody saying, gee, Steph, you're almost 58 and you've got some lines on your forehead. I'm like, no shit, Sherlock. Well done. Well done. Well done. So I just wrote back, bro, I'm almost 58 and I'm going to have some wrinkles. Yeah, I'm going to have some lines on my forehead and I'm going to have some, stuff under my eyes. I mean, that's just natural, right? I just said, you might want to say something positive about a funny picture because your life will be better. Your life will probably be better if you respond to a funny picture with something positive, or, with a funny picture, don't say, hey, man, you must be super stressed. You got lines on your forehead and you got lines under your eyes? I'm like, yes, I do. And the alternative to that is to not be here, right? The alternative to wrinkles is death, right? I mean, I ain't the 27 club guy, right? Live fast, die young, leave a good-looking corpse. That's not my thing because that doesn't maximize philosophy. So if I had gotten, this is just a tiny example I just wrote back and then forgot about it, but it then comes up in the context of this. So if I had written back and said, I look fantastic, show me a picture of you, I bet you look like shit, you know, something like that, then the person can say, hey man, I just made a comment and Steph just went nuts, right? So if you just come back with a reasonable statement, then people's craziness becomes clear to them. So people who are crazy avoid relatively calm, reasonable people. They just do. And so if you are sane, reasonable, and strong in the world, crazy people will just part like the Red Sea before you. They will just absolutely avoid you. In the same way that propagandized people avoid people who are curious, because curiosity is an acceptance of the limitations of our knowledge, and propaganda is assuming you have the perfect final answers for everything and it's been handed to you with no reasoning, right? It is the pretense of knowledge. A propaganda is like those funny little sort of sun overalls that you can get in Florida and other places where it has, like, you know, big boobs, narrow waist, wide hips. It's got this cartoon perfect figure, this Jessica Rabbit figure on it, and you just put that on and you think you look like that, right? Because that's the conclusion of youth and exercise and diet and so on, and you can get some, you know, overweight grandma who can put that on, and she, it's a joke, right? I mean, so it is funny. So that's propaganda, right? It's giving you the conclusions of years of work and all of that without any reasoning, without any process. They just give you a towel to put on to make you look fit, and then you think you're all that and a slice of bread. So just be sane, and the crazy people will absolutely avoid you, and they'll sense it. They'll sense it. It's funny because I used to have crazy people who would try to tangle with me, and then they'd back off. Now, I'm so, you know, calm, reasonable, peaceful, and they sense that sort of strength and confidence and self-knowledge and so on, that they don't even tangle with me. I can't even remember the last time, certainly in my life, that anyone who was unstable had anything to say to me. They don't. It's like we're absolutely in, like, same planet, different worlds. So, all right. A lot of people say they believe in the theory of evolution, but how many do you think actually understand it? What do you think? How on earth am I supposed to know that? I mean, microevolution has been accepted forever and ever, amen, right? I mean, that's how we domesticated animals and fruits and vegetables and so on. I mean, look at what the original corn looks like in the wild back in the day, and you'll realize just how much clipping and merging. And so microevolution has been accepted forever, and there is almost no A religious person, who even a fundamentalist person, would not say there's no such thing as microevolution. But macroevolution, differentiation of species and so on, that's harder to prove because, of course, the fossil record is so slight. If we had, like, the entire human population of North America, if it was all wiped out, you would find one thigh bone in the future. That's how many fossils we find relative to the actual story of life. So I have no idea how many people actually understand the theory. I don't know what you mean by actually understand. I don't know if any surveys have been done. So that's a data question, which is only interesting if you have the data. But if a data question and nobody has the data, there's no philosophy involved, right? Should we send our daughter to private school? She's been homeschooled her whole life, and then last year she went to private school for about 80% of the school year. We did a late enrollment. We wanted her to continue to go, but she does not want to go. Citing disagreements with classmates, teasing, overall, I think it's a good school and our other two kids enjoy going there. What is the balance between pushing your kids outside of their comfort zone and also taking into consideration them not wanting to do something? Our kids were forced into piano when they were younger and hated it, so we stopped. They will occasionally say they were glad they were forced to play piano because it gave them a skill and they will still play. That's the moral dilemma I'm trying to articulate. Thanks, Steph. Well, it depends on the kid. I mean, there's no one, other than no violations of the non-aggression principle and no abuse, you know, some kids are open to coaching, right? Some kids are open to coaching. my daughter is not particularly open to coaching. When she has something to do that I have a lot of experience in, I have to be very, very, very delicate on the feedback I give her. It's not exactly the same as disarming a bomb, but it's not exactly the opposite either. So when it comes to my daughter, she's got a lot of great natural talents, a lot of great natural abilities, and she's ferociously hard at working at stuff that she wants to learn. But if she has, I don't even want to get into the content because that's sort of a distraction. If she has some task to perform, particularly in public, that I have a lot of experience in, I can't give her much feedback. And I understand where she's coming from, because she has her way of doing it. And if I give her what I think is the, quote, correct or right or trained way to do it, then that is going to interfere with her natural expression, and she can end up stilted, right? So if somebody's like a really fast runner, and they go to a coach, and the coach says, do this, do that, do the other, it will screw up their running for a while, right? As they unlearn their natural habits and learn something better. I mean, I remember when I first got coaching in racket sports, I had a way of playing, and then I got coaching, and it screwed up my game for quite a while. So some kids are more coachable, some kids are more ferocious in wanting to do it by themselves, right? My very first sentence as a child, my very first complete sentence at the age of two or so was, leave me with what I'm doing. And here I am working alone. Leave me with what I'm doing. It really, really doesn't change too much. You get the brain you get, right? So some kids may like school more, some kids may like school less. So if your kid doesn't want to go to school, then why would you make your kid go to school? You say, oh, well, she'll thank us later. It's like, okay, but if she changes her mind later, then she'll do it on her own. So as you say, you, quote, forced your kids to play piano, and that's fine. I mean, you can get your kids and say, give it a shot, you know, and you can make deals with them to try it for a month or two. And so you forced your kids to play piano, and now they're glad that they were forced to do it. So you force your kids to play piano. I mean, I know you're not talking about forcing them, like encouraging them or making deals with them. So your kids play piano, and now they play piano voluntarily, and you stop forcing them to play piano. So you make deals with kids, and if the kids accept the deals, then you hold them to the deals, right? So if you want your kid to play piano, you can make a deal with the kid that says, how can we negotiate so that you will commit to playing piano for a month or two and maybe getting some teaching or whatever, right? So what deals can we make? And if you can't make any deals, then you can't like hold her down and force her to play piano, right? And you shouldn't. So you work to make deals. And that teaches kids about deals, and it teaches them about negotiation, and it teaches them about following through, and it teaches them about negotiation regret, right? Where sometimes you regret your negotiations, but you still have to be held to it, right? So whatever you can negotiate with kids, you can hold them to. But if they don't want to negotiate, and it's like, there's nothing that you can do that is going to make me want to play piano, then, if you can't negotiate with your kids, you can't get them to do stuff. Because the only other thing you're teaching them, if you don't negotiate them but genuinely force them to do them, is that they're bigger and stronger. You're bigger and stronger, and their will means nothing in the face of your size and power. Okay, that's just setting them up for abusive relationships. So yeah, well, whatever you can negotiate with. If you can negotiate with your kid to go to school, then they go to school. If they don't want to go to school and you can't negotiate with them to go to school, then they don't go to school. If they regret it later, you say, but we negotiated, and you had experience of homeschooling, you had experience of schooling, you don't tell me how old your kids are, and you negotiate, right? Now, there's other things that you can do that are negotiation-based, right? Like, I mean, you don't want your kids to eat candy all day, so you just don't have candy in the house. And they say, where's the candy? Well, we don't have any. Can we go out to get any? No, I don't want to. Well, then they have to find something else to eat. So some of negotiation is just not having stuff around, but yeah, you negotiate with your kids, and they'll have to live with the consequences of their negotiating. I mean, I negotiated with my daughter to take some piano lessons. She played it for a while. She didn't particularly like it. And so we stopped. Now, if she were to come to me and say, I wish you'd forced me to keep going, I mean, she never would. And she never has said anything like that to me. If she says now she wants to learn piano, I'd be like, hey, we're happy to facilitate that again. if you want to learn piano. But there's never been a statement in my family like, I wish you'd kept forcing me to do something, because I never forced her to do anything. I wish you had encouraged. Just like, well, we do encourage, but you know, my daughter, a little bit resistance to outside pressure, which, you know, I'm gonna be the last one to complain about her thinking for herself, opposing outside pressure and wanting to cut her own path through the woods. I'm absolutely fine with that. I would be completely hypocritical for me to have a big problem with that. So yeah, you negotiate with your kids. If they later regret their negotiations, that's part of life, man. That teaches them to think further down the road when they negotiate. So, all right. Tucker Carlson remarked recently that Bitcoin was probably invented by the CIA. It sounds crazy to me that the CIA has been doing very shady things for a long time. I'd love to get your thoughts. I mean, I would be very surprised if Bitcoin was invented by the CIA. The CIA lives on fiat currency, and inventing the ultimate replacement for fiat currency would be quite nuts. It would say that the people in the CIA are able to look 20 years down the road to see the value of Bitcoin, and that they don't mind that if Bitcoin becomes a replacement for fiat currency, there'll be precious little funding to the CIA. So it would be like, let's look 20 years down the road, which is not generally the case. Power is a moment-by-moment affair, which is why it looks so chaotic and leads in such a bad direction. Is that, I mean, if the government, if anyone in the government was capable of looking down the road, we wouldn't have a national debt, right? Because they'd be saying, well, this is really bad. We wouldn't have unfunded liabilities, or in America, what the unfunded liabilities are, well over $200 trillion, right? If anyone in the government had the capacity to look down the road and act decisively, they wouldn't be the government. Power is a moment-by-moment affair. It's like when you're chatting with someone who's a real manipulator, all they're trying to do is win in the moment. They don't care about contradictions. They don't care about what might happen later. They're just trying to win in the moment. This is why relationships end up so bad, as people try to win in the moment and they don't realize that they're actually destroying their relationship downstream over time. They don't care. It's like being severely overweight as an adult, like assuming you weren't fed that way as a kid. It's just a moment-by-moment affair. I like to eat this. I like to eat that. I don't want to exercise. I want another soda. And it's just a moment-by-moment. You're not thinking, well, 10 years down the road, or 20 years down the road, I could have a heart attack. You're not thinking, you know, that's addiction is always a moment-by-moment affair. Always. Like, so the addicts who steal from their family in order to get their drugs, they're not sitting there saying, well, I'm destroying my family structure. I'm causing everyone who cares about me to hate and fear me. They're just like, I just need the drug. So the idea that there's some, you know, 20, 30 year plan put out with the CIA to replace the entire source of their funding would seem to me absolutely unbelievable. I mean, is it possible? I mean, but there's so many things that are possible, right? I mean, I could get struck by lightning doing a show outside rather than inside, right? Every time you go for a hike in the woods, I guess theoretically in some places you could get attacked by a bear. Every time you work out, you could find out that you have some bone-rotting disease and you could break an arm just lifting a weight. I mean, there is every risk known to man. We play the odds. We play the bell curve. And I wouldn't put one Satoshi on that being invented by people in the CIA. But, you know, I just can't see it in any way, shape, or form happening. So, all right. Well, I hope that helps. If you'd like to submit more questions at freedomain.locals.com, you can also sign up at subscribestar.com/freedomain. And of course, support for the show is always very, very humbly and gratefully accepted, which is freedomain.com/donate. And I'll see you tonight, Wednesday night, 7 p.m. and Friday night, 7 p.m. and Sunday mornings, 11 a.m. We do our live streams. Love to chat with you there. We can even do call-ins now, which is fantastic. You can submit questions as well. So, love you guys. Thank you for these great questions and comments. Lots of love. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.